The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. You must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
Welcome to the BS Report, taping this on a Friday morning here in sunny Southern California on the Subway Fresh Take hotline for the first time in a while from Grantland.com. Author, gentleman, music fan. I don't know what else to put in this intro. Chuck Klosterman, what's happening?
Nothing. Everything and nothing.
All right. Linsanity, have you gotten caught up in this?
Yes, I have, to a degree. I think everyone has, right?
Yes, everyone has.
There's several things I wanted to talk to you about this. First of all, I mean, you've been writing a lot about it, so some of your opinions are already out there. I was thinking about this quite a bit. The obvious comparison, the thing that everyone, of course, is making, is with Tebow. And sort of the sensation around Tim Tebow and how, in many ways, it's totally different. And then in other ways, it's similar. I'm curious what you think the similarities are. Because to me, there might be one unifying element here. And everybody else is sort of writing about, because there is the clear difference that Tebow is always, like, just finding a way to win at the end, where it kind of seems like Lynn is just kind of killing people out there. Why do you think that they are, what parts of it are similar to you?
The only parts that are similar in my mind are that, one, that he came out of nowhere and just, you know, was sitting there. And
but that's how they're different, because Tebow won the Heisman.
Well, but I mean, as a professional, people had kind of thought, all right, well, this guy's over here on the bench and he's going to do this and that's where it's going to end. And then he came out of nowhere and turned a team around during a point in their season when it was dead.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the biggest similarity, is that when Tebow took over the Broncos, they were dead and they were looking at the Andrew Luck sweepstakes and the whole thing. And when Jerry Mullin came in for the Knicks, they were 8-15. And headed for the lottery, and the Knicks fans were like trying to figure out the protections of their draft pick, because Houston has their pick, but it's like top 10 protected this year. And, you know, they were having all those conversations. Should we trade Melo? What do we do? And they kind of just came out of nowhere and saved it. And I think the other thing is, just from a similarity standpoint, they're both really unique to watch, right? Like Tebow plays quarterback like nobody else plays quarterback. And I think Lynn, there's similarities to his game with J.J. Barea and people like that. Like, he's a scoring point guard. He's, the way he uses the high screen is like Nash. But the overall package is pretty unique, whether he was black, white, Asian. I don't think it would matter. I think his actual basketball game is really unique. And I think that's what has helped him catch on a lot like Tebow. There's something about him that's just really fun and different to watch. Would you agree?
Well, this is sort of that second point of yours kind of leads me to the thing I wanted to bring up, and I'm wondering if you will agree with this or disagree. I'm sort of thinking about this. I don't know if I have any real evidence, but I'm going to throw it out there. I'm wondering if sort of the intensity of feeling toward Tebow and Lynn has to do with sort of a collective desire for a break in logic, because our lives now are so built around sort of statistical, provable, almost mechanical sense.
Oh, that's interesting.
And that if the reason people like these guys or feel so strongly about these guys, because the other big, you know, the big difference to me in some ways, too, is the kind of person who might hate Tebow often will love Lynn. Because, you know, it's often, a lot of people, I think, are drawn to Jeremy Lin because, you know, he went to Harvard. And especially for people in the media on the East Coast, for so many of the outlets, they're really dominated by, especially the major ones, they're dominated by people who went to Ivy Leagues or at least to sort of like, you know, East Coast kind of liberal arts colleges, that they see, you know, elements of this guy who reminds them of maybe someone that they once knew or of themselves or whatever. And they might have been the people who were the strongest critics of Tebow. But the thing that's the same is that at this point, you know, aren't we almost accustomed to watching sports from a way that is no longer supposed to be subjective? That we're supposed, like, you know, when you read sports stories, if they don't lean heavily on kind of hard statistics or these kind of quantifiable elements, the speed of the guy in the 40 or how he performed at the combine or whatever, it immediately comes into question. Anybody who supports an athlete basically in the kind of old media way where just like, I like this guy has something different, it's just seen as absolutely absurd.
Yeah.
So now we have these two cases where that is happening, and I'm wondering if in all aspects of society that we are now going to be drawn toward a logical situation. If maybe that's why in politics sometimes people are drawn toward a logical character, or when they're consuming entertainment, they're drawn to things that are constructed in a way that seems flawed because we've really grown comfortable with the idea that everything is explainable.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that was one of the things I loved about Tebow, which was the NFL guys, the diehard, whoever the people on the different networks, the talking heads, the people who write about football, they were so convinced that this was a fluke and this was, he just didn't have it and it just couldn't last and he was missing this and this and this, and yet the team was winning and he kept coming through. And that's what made it fun for me, was that he was kind of shoving it in the face of this feeling that sports has to be totally logical and make sense. The weird thing about Lynn, though, is I feel like it's a different experience, because in Lynn's case, everybody's agreeing that he's good. And it is, the narrative has become more of, well, why didn't he get a chance sooner than this? Well, what happened?
Well, how did
so many people mess this up? That seems like that's the narrative for this time around, right?
I mean, it is strange, because going into the season, if you were to have ranked every player in the league in order of talent,
yep,
it wouldn't have been outrageous to put him last, right? That could have, there could be someone's list where he would have been last or near last, right?
He would have been in the 400s. I mean, I didn't know enough about it. I remember when Golden State, he ended up on Golden State last year. I don't remember at what point in the season. I remember thinking, oh, that's smart. You know, there's huge Asian community in Golden State. They're not a very good team. It'll drum up some interest for them. And never, you know, I have a friend who is friends with him, and who always said that if he ever got a chance, he could be a real backup point guard. And it was one of those things like, yeah, all right, whatever. And he certainly, like, you look at the stats last year, he certainly didn't, you know, make a huge impact on Golden State.
But particularly if he's in, let's say he's in the 400s 3 weeks ago or 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Okay, now he is in, I mean, assuming he would play exactly as he has been for the rest of the year, which is probably not going to happen, but if it did, he would be in the top 25 in the league, right? And I wonder if people see this and they're like, see, we don't know everything. People don't know as many advances as we have made with statistical analysis, and the more we get to see guys and the more sort of effort is placed on trying to deduce people's, you know, talent, and for the most part they tend to be more right than wrong. Every once in a while there's just these glaring exceptions, and I wonder now if people are sort of predisposed to just respond to any situation where the overall institution seemed to have been wrong.
Well,
that happens so rarely in every aspect of life now.
Yeah, I think there's something to that, but I mean, you can make a case there's nine different elements going. Like, for instance, when Ryan Fitzpatrick started playing well for the Bills, that became like a real story, and it was like, look at this. This guy went to Harvard, and now he's a quarterback, and that really became like a legitimate thing that people talked about. So even if Lynn wasn't Taiwanese-American, I still think it would be a story that the white Harvard point guard was rejuvenated next season. That would have been, he's an underdog. How did he fall through the cracks? Is there an Ivy League bias? All of those things I think would have been stories. But the fact that, you know, there just hasn't been that many Asian athletes that have crossed over, whether they're Asian, Asian American, whatever. And I do think that's a big part of this. Is like my buddy Chen explained this pretty well, I thought. He said, look at the crossover Asian athletes that we've seen, like Ichiro, Japanese, barely said anything, like not somebody that, like if I asked you describe Ichiro in 500 words, you would have a trouble coming up with 200.
But also he's coming from a place where there's a real baseball tradition. That's another
part.
So it didn't seem impossible that they could produce somebody who was, I mean, I guess, the best leadoff hitter in baseball for a handful of years, right?
Right. And before him, Hideo Nomo, Chin-Ming Wong from Taiwan. Then Yao Ming comes over. He's the first, you know, gigantic basketball star. In his case, you could say a lot. You wouldn't really totally identify with him because he was 7'6". And his height and his size became more of a story with Yao Ming and then eventually his injuries and all that than anything. Also,
There was also that weird element with him, which is that, you know, he's coming from a country with a billion people or whatever. It was almost like, well, statistically, at one point, there was going to be this outlier.
Right.
You know, and here again, it's sort of made in some strange kind of sense, you know, that it didn't seem like I can't imagine someone like, I never thought there would be, a talented big man from China that, I never heard that said, you know.
Right. And also he was one of those guys, he knew more English than he let on, but was never a guy, was never the most gregarious, outgoing, you know, personality. He was likable. But then the next guy, Wei Yang, the golfer, was somebody that, you know, it's golf. You're only going to go so far in golf, especially if you're not Tiger, Phil Mickelson. And he also didn't keep winning after that one big thing. I mean, he was in the mix after that, but was never somebody who became one of the top five golfers or anything. And now you have Jeremy Lin, who grew up in America and seems like somebody we could have gone to college with, we would have known, somebody we would go out to a bar with, stuff like that. And it seems like maybe that's part of this too a little bit. Like the fact that he is the most identifiable Asian American or whatever athlete that we've seen kind of cross over. And for that community, I feel like they're even more attached to this story than they maybe were to Yao or Ichiro or any of those other stories, because it's like, this is our guy. I could potentially have been this guy. You know what I mean? Like you identify with him in a different way. And I think that's helped.
There's always that idea of saying like someone is beloved because, you know, we can identify with him. But I mean, the fact of the matter is if people try hard enough, they can identify with whoever they want. They can make the decision that they identify with, Isaiah Ryder or whatever. If they, in their mind, they decide that they're going to find elements in their life that matches his. There's just all these things about it that I think that are part of the reason why, besides just the enthusiasm, it's just very interesting to think about. I mean, he kind of plays this different style of basketball. That I think it's, maybe you talk about people identifying with. I think some people think he's playing, this kind of classic pick and roll style. And I was thinking of, you know, Ricky Rubio, who seemed like he was regressing, you know, before he came over here, and now even though that they both have a lot of turnovers, they're both really excelling here. Like, you think there's something fundamentally wrong with American basketball, and that maybe we are overlooking sort of how the way the game has changed over time has eroded the way they play to a degree where these guys who bring in I know that it's wrong to say Lin is using, you know, he's not a European player, but he's sort of playing this European style.
Well, he could easily have pretended to be a European player. I mean, obviously we would have known he wasn't because he went to Harvard, but he could easily pretend that he grew up in Spain or France or some weird country, and it would make, like, what we're watching from him would make more sense because it's so kind of quirky and unconventional for that position. I agree with you. It's the way he plays point and the way Rubio plays point. feels a lot different than, like, say, the John Wall way. I went and saw John Wall in person on Wednesday night. Phenomenal athlete. Just no sense of how to handle that position yet. You know, it's just not there yet. And he's doing it all on athletic ability. And you watch somebody like Lynn, like one of the things I love about Lynn, watching him and why I think he's legit is, you know, something simple like when he throws the lob pass to Chandler. There's a timing to the lob pass, and the real way to do it is a half second early or a second early before anyone is even thinking it's going to happen. Lynn's really good at that. He'll be in the paint, and he'll just throw it up, and he'll be like, what's he doing? And then there's Chandler, and Chandler dunks it. And, you know, that's like a point guard instinct thing. And going back to why people didn't think Lynn was going to make it, he was a shooting guard at Harvard. And I think the big question for him coming out of college was, what position is he? Well, he's a 6'2" point guard. Well, is he going to be quick enough to guard other point guards? Well, maybe he's a shooting guard. Well, he's too small then. Like, nobody kind of knew how to pigeonhole him into whatever spot we seem to have on these NBA rosters, where the bottom line is it's like a J.J. Brea thing. It doesn't really matter. He comes in, he makes plays.
Yeah. But just kind of getting back to this thing, this not knowing thing, I really think that this is a big part of it. And it's sort of kind of consuming me. Okay, a friend of mine and I were having a conversation recently. I can't remember how it started, but you're talking about the 1972 presidential election.
Yeah.
Okay, and John Lennon is watching the results come in a hotel with Yoko Ono. And I know this could be an apocryphal story, I don't know, but they're watching the results. They're, of course, really big McGovern people. And when the results come in, you know, like, John Lennon is so shocked, basically, like, howls, grabs a random woman in the hotel, pulls her into a bedroom, and has sex with her out of anger while her wife cries, while his wife cries out in the main room, okay? You know, it's this crazy story, right? Like, he's just so blown away and so angry and upset by this that he just can't believe this. And that kind of, you know, caused that was right before then, like, Yoko Ono sent Lennon to live in Los Angeles by himself, and he went through or actually with a woman she set him up with, and kind of went through this industry. But the main thing that is crazy about this story is 1972 is not that long ago. I mean, I guess it's 40 years now. It's when,
yeah.
But he had no idea Nixon was going to win. Like, there was no polling accurate enough to make it. I mean, it was this massive landslide. He's
right.
Living in New York. He's obviously within a group of people who are very informed about the world. But as recently as 1972, somebody could have absolutely no idea how a landslide presidential election was going to turn out.
Right.
And, you know, and he had this emotional response. But that scenario today can't even happen. There's nothing that meaningful that wouldn't be understood or accurately predicted. Like, I'm sure if Nate Silver had been around in 1972, with the technology he has now, he probably could have predicted that election exactly. Like, he would have got the electoral votes exactly right. Would have got the popular votes almost exactly right.
Yep.
And I wonder if people unconsciously miss that. If a part of us is sort of sad that everything about our life now can basically be told before it happens. And every time we see these situations, like Tebow or Lynn, where it just makes no sense whatsoever and everyone was wrong, it makes people happy.
Don't you think that happens with movies a lot? Like, I feel like every year there's a movie that nobody sees coming, and that becomes part of the reason for its success, like The Artist this year. The Artist, like, was, you know, it's like, whoa, where'd this movie come from? Oh, my God. Oh, it might win the Oscar. And really, like, the best thing that it had going for it was that it came out of nowhere. Whereas you take a movie like, I don't know, The Descendants with George Clooney. Like, everybody knows it's Alexander Payne and George Clooney that's going to be a good movie. Like, you have that on the radar screen for 2 years. But it's almost more fun to get caught up in the Artist momentum.
Although there's sort of a tradition of movies like The Artist emerging that way. This idea that
it happens every year.
Yeah, you know, whereas as things like Lynn and Tebow don't happen every year, and that's what's so jarring about them. Like, it's very safe for us to say that at some point this year, a movie is going to come out, and it's going to be made for a small amount of money, and it's going to get really great reviews, and it's going to become very popular and very memorable. That will happen this year, and that will happen next year. There will not be a situation, I would assume, like Tebow in football this year. I don't think there'll be a character like Lynn in the NBA every year going forward.
But here's the thing.
Unless people are so hungry for this that they're simply going to latch on to any scenario where, you know, where somebody seemingly is succeeding against reason.
I think there's two parts here. First, I think it's the Tebow thing is a fluke. I can't call it a fluke. An aberration. I don't think it happens again. I don't think this Jeremy Lin thing, the way that it happens, is something that is going to happen like 5 years from now or 8 years from now. What's interesting with the movie thing is, as you said, it does happen every year, but now they consciously try to figure out how to make it happen. Like, for instance, Jason Reitman told me when he did the when they were doing the promotion for Young Adult, they had this whole game plan because it could have gone into the Toronto Film Festival in September, and they were kind of studying how the last couple years had played out, and they realized it made more sense not to do that because you don't want to peak early, you want to sneak up on people, you want to surprise people at the tail end, and that seemed to be the recipe that actually worked. And so they made this conscious effort not to push the movie ahead of when it was coming out, which in the past, people always want to get the buzz going, and you put the trailer, and you put the trailer in the Super Bowl, and you know, you have this ad campaign that starts 4 months early. And now Hollywood is realizing, yeah, that's actually not what you want to do. You want to peak in January and February.
Well, it's almost like any attempt to decide things like that beforehand dooms you to failure.
Yes.
Like, you know, I mean, Young Adult's an interesting example. I thought it was great. I mean, I didn't really, I haven't been, a, like, I didn't like Juno. I wasn't a big fan of like, the early Diablo Cody movies.
Yeah.
And I thought this movie was just awesome. And it was basically sort of the removal of all the things from her previous movies I didn't like as much, with all the stuff that really was great, plus Charlize Theron was great, Patton Oswalt was great. It would have probably made more sense, in retrospect, to just promote that movie as, this is a good movie that's darker than most.
Yeah.
And I think it would have, you know, because it seemed to have gotten almost no attention. I feel like it's already disappeared.
Yeah, I thought she was incredible in it. Like, when I saw an early screening of it, and I came out of it going, wow, she's going to win the Oscar. That's the best Charlize Theron movie that could possibly happen for her. She's everything you would want her to be in that movie. She's crazy. She's hot. She's a really good actress. Like, and she didn't get nominated.
But yeah, I mean, it was also an interesting movie that it was actually pro-alcoholism. Not just pro-drinking. It was actually pro-alcoholism, and I was like, this is an amazing movie. Like, that they've made this choice. But it's this idea of trying to sort of, you know, figure out beforehand how these things should work. Like, have you been watching Luck?
No, I have three of them on my DVR. It seems like a pretty big mental haul. And that's why I've been saving
isn't it kind of directed right at you, though?
It is. That's why I wanted to, when I watched them, I wanted to really throw myself into it. And I haven't had that, haven't been ready mentally yet.
Well, I'm not going to give anything away, but, okay, I watched the whole season. We had a screener of it, right, the whole thing.
Mm.
I really like it. But it is interesting how it really struck me as one of the first times when somebody went into a project and said, okay, these kind of high-end dramas on HBO, they're awesome if you follow this template.
Yep.
Opening credits is kind of supposed to be like this. We need this kind of music and these kind of images. We can get big-time actors now from film to come on and be involved with these TV projects, so let's get Nick Nolte and Dustin Hoffman and convince them to do this, you know. You know, you need to have sort of a writer who is unassailable, that he's already assumed to be a genius, so they get Milch. And, like, we need a big-time director, so we get Michael Mann. And we have to have multiple storylines that are only tangentially intertwined, but have the potential to become completely intertwined. And they've done all of these things, and the show is very good, and yet it does seem less organic and natural than the shows that it's trying to replicate, which is like, you know, The Wire and Sopranos and those shows, you know. It really does seem impossible to make something work if you go into it with a defined idea of what the end product is supposed to be.
Well, the other problem, you know, it does seem like going with that template you talked about. One of the things that seems like they like to do with all their shows is to not kind of shoot their wad with the first episode. Like, you use the first few episodes to set up later in the season. Like, every HBO show is like that. Now, Homeland, which I thought was better than any HBO show that I've seen the last few years, they kind of grabbed you with the pilot. Like, you watch the pilot and you're like, wow, that was awesome. If the pilot was on tonight, I'd probably watch it because I enjoyed it the first time. And then it whet your appetite for the rest of the season. It does seem like HBO's left the door open for Showtime. I feel like Homeland's better than any HBO show. I also don't like Boardwalk Empire. A lot of people do. I don't know where you stand on that.
I watched the whole first season of that, and I only watched the second season sort of hither and yon kind of. It's another example of a show that I do know is good, and yet I am less involved with it than... I guess I don't know why. I mean, I can't even really give a cogent criticism of why I lost interest, but somehow I did. It wasn't that fun to watch.
Yeah, I don't think Luck. I started watching for 10 minutes, and Luck was like beautifully shot and all that stuff, but it wasn't that much fun to watch. And it was like I felt like it was going to be a chore to watch it, which is why I was saving them for the right time, but. I think that's something that HBO's kind of lost these last few years. Like, they don't – even, like, The Wire is shown on DirecTV 101, and they're shown season 3 right now. I got sucked into 2 episodes over the weekend just because I like the characters so much. I miss them. I'm like, I'm just going to watch this. I haven't seen them in a while. Hey, there's Stringer. Oh, awesome. Hey, there's Marlo. Hey, there's Omar. Like, there is something to be said for that. You know, like, it's okay to be entertaining and have entertaining characters and – maybe that's why people like True Blood, though. Don't people feel that way about True Blood?
Yeah, True Blood is, I think, like a kind of a campier thing, and the idea is that you can watch it without sort of taking it seriously. Whereas these high-end shows, they're kind of just, in many ways, replacing reading in the culture. They're like
yeah,
for
it's
people
true.
Who they're like for people who because you know, and it would have been absolutely insane. I think we've talked about this on other podcasts. Like, there is a, I'm sure we have in fact, but there's like an essay that Joyce Carol Oates wrote for TV Guide in the 80s, I think it was.
Yeah.
Where she talked about how she kind of blew her mind that her and her friends were really into Hill Street Blues. And they actually cared about Hill Street Blues and they were taking it seriously. You know, it's odd because now anybody who follows TV takes it seriously. It's almost weird if you don't. People get mad at you if you want to talk about a show and you haven't seen every episode because they don't feel they can have a conversation then because they will give something away. And,
right.
And I mean, that's just been a total change. So now I think the kind of person who would have read novels in their free time in like 1978, that kind of person now is really into these intense, you know, serialized sort of heavy HBO high-end television. And I mean, you just see there's something that's happening. Like, people aren't buying books the way they used to. They certainly don't talk about books in the culture the way they used to. They've had to replace it with something, and I think this was it.
And, you know, what's interesting is there's...
Because you'd never criticize a novel, you'd never criticize a novel, or you'd be a bad critic if you did, by saying, like, the first 40 pages are just set up.
Right.
You know, and people say that about TV all the time. I heard people talking about the first episode of The River, and then that, and you know how I think it was actually Chris Ryan and Andy Greenwald. They were pleased that immediately the show is sort of kind of like right into movement, right into the story or whatever. And it is. I'm not against them doing that, but it's strange that that is surprising to people now. You know that there's some issue with having an episode that's all set up because TV was never like that.
But the fascinating thing to me about TV is TV has kind of gone into two directions because the old way that we grew up with still exists. Like, you watch Hawaii Five-0, and that's kind of like the TV we grew up with. It's like, hey, here's a mindless hour of television and characters that, you know because you've watched the shows over the years, but you could also step into any episode and watch it and digest it and not think about it again after that. So you have that whole – that's over there. And then you have the HBO, Showtime, FX, AMC shows that you can't just jump in. And if you come in late, you have to go and you have to get the DVDs on Netflix or get Netflix streamings. Downton Abbey is like this. I think I told you. I don't know if I talked to us on a podcast, but I remember telling you on the phone about how my wife and I watched 5 Downton Abbey episodes in my hotel in Boston.
Yeah, you it was like you hooked up your computer to the.
Yeah, we hooked up the iPad with like some HDMI cable to the hotel and watched all these Downton Abbey episodes. And I thought like, it's really kind of, 2012 is amazing. Like you basically everything you want in life is on demand now. And it can all be based off this little iPad, whether you want to read a book, whether you want to watch any of these shows. I mean, you could download the first season of Luck and catch up on that. But it seems like it's just much easier to throw yourself into an entire season of something now. But you still have that other option of, oh, TV's on and I'm bored. I'm going to see what's on whatever channel. I don't think it's fair, though. You know, that they need to really reconfigure the Emmys. It bothers me that like a show like Boardwalk Empire would compete against CSI and NCIS. Like those shows have nothing in common. Boardwalk Empire could spend, what, $80 million on a season and can get any actor they want. And Hawaii Five-0's got to crank out 22 episodes. Like there's no correlation to those two shows.
Well, I mean, a couple things. One, I mean, but... You know, Hawaii Five-0 is rewarded in a different way in that it has a much larger audience and is more and actually is, well, maybe not as engaging people as deeply. It's engaging more people, so that's kind of its reward. I mean, its success is its reward.
Well, but what about the good? Well, hold on though. What about The Good Wife though? Like that's a show that critics really like and respect, and they're putting out I think 22 a year, and Boardwalk Empire puts out maybe 10, and they get more money to spend and everything. Like it just seems like there's a higher degree of difficulty to making The Good Wife good than an HBO show where they say money's no object. Go
well,
get whoever
but,
you want.
Yeah, but also the bar is much different. If an episode of Boardwalk Empire came across like one of those procedural shows like The Good Wife or whatever, it would be torn apart. Nobody would take it seriously. Look at what happened to The Killing. I mean, like, The Killing was just absolutely hammered because it sort of, the season sort of ended as badly as a traditional TV show would. But it was just sort of like it's on AMC, so that means it's going to be like Mad Men or Breaking Bad, and the expectation is totally different. I do think the degree of difficulty to make... Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I suppose the hardest thing is just to make a show that a lot of people like, regardless of whatever the aesthetic merits. I don't know. It's an interesting question. I guess I don't care about the Emmys. Why do you care about the Emmys?
Well, no, it's more of like I'm just talking about the degree of difficulty of stuff. Because to me, like, I think those shows are miniseries. Like, remember Rich Man, Poor Man when we were growing up, or like Roots.
Yeah.
Those were miniseries back then, but they're basically the exact same thing as these shows we see now. Like the first season of Breaking Bad was 7 episodes. How is that a television show? That's a miniseries. That's 7 episodes that are strung together.
So this is a little bit like how for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, you need to have guitars. For television shows, you need to have 20 episodes. They have these weird things.
I just think cable should have a different category. I think they should all – the cable shows should all compete against each other and network shows should compete against each other. And
you're just in general a big award show guy though. Like don't – like you like the Grammys and stuff, right?
No,
I find it
– I hate the Grammys.
Now. This is one thing that – just mystifying, like I don't think I've ever watched the Grammys. I was trying to think if there would ever been a time in my life when I did. I've never watched one in its entirety, totally. But then, like, I go on Twitter and so many people are involved with the Grammys. It's really weird to me.
But here's what we're missing, Chuck. Like, and we have this in sports and in pop culture. We've kind of failed. There's no way to really measure what happened in a year in an effective way, you know. And I think the Oscars maybe comes the closest because we can look at the Oscars and go, "Oh yeah, that was the year that I don't know, Saving Private Ryan won." Yeah, that was the Saving Private Ryan year or whatever. The Grammys can tap into that sometimes. Like 2011 was definitely Adele's year, Like, I think if you look back at their year musically, you're going to think of her first because she, what was she, number one for 27 straight weeks or something. That album sold like gangbusters. She had a great voice. She was the first female traditional type of pop singer that people had gotten excited about in a while. And in this case, the Grammys kind of captured that. There's been, most of the time, the Grammys doesn't capture that. Like, you know, you just look at like who's nominated every year for best rock. It's always like bands that have passed their peak, you know, 7-8 years ago and things like that. It's weird to me that we haven't been able to do a better job of capturing so that like 20 years from now, you look back and you go, what happened in 2011? Oh, I'll look at the awards. Like that's not going to help you because we don't have an effective system. That's why I think awards matter.
Yes, I mean, so you're saying, whereas in, say, the NBA or whatever, I could go back to and look at the statistics and the All-Pro team from 1964 and get a pretty accurate snapshot of what the league was like.
Yeah, you look at the MVP votes, you look at the All-NBA team, you look at the playoffs, you look at the scoring, rebounding, assist leaders. Like, you can basically, do you have enough information that you could break down exactly what happened and who mattered? And in movies, we probably have come up with, hey, you're talking about movies versus TV versus music. I think movies have the Oscars as people kind of take that the most seriously.
Oh, definitely.
I don't think anyone takes the Grammys seriously. And the Emmys, you know, whatever. Like The Wire I don't think The Wire even got nominated for Best Series. Like, it does seem like that's been pretty out of whack the last 10, 12 years. Thrown on top of the fact that the cable versus basic cable, it's almost like in soccer, how, you know, in English soccer, how there's like the four or five teams that can spend so much money and they win every year. And then there are the other teams that can spend, you know, much less money and they're just trying to compete. Television's a little bit like that. The difference is that CBS, you know, makes a crap load of money with what they're doing. So as you said, it's hard to feel sorry for some of the networks, but I do think it's much harder to make a network show that succeeds. Like even the show Smash, who I haven't seen, but to have a show that critics like, but is also watched by a lot of people seems like the hardest thing to do. Would you agree?
Yeah. I mean, those are the two hard things. So if you go after both of them, that's going to be the most difficult. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's difficult enough to do one of those things, but I guess, you know,
I think it'd be pretty easy to say, let's spend a lot of money on a horse racing drama and we'll get David Milch and Michael Mann. And at that point, you know, it's probably going to work. I think it would be much harder to say, how do we capture Broadway in a network series?
There's another thing here though. It's sort of like, okay, you're saying it's easier for HBO to do this, but I mean, isn't the kind of the idea, I mean, this is what I assume in a larger sense is the idea. It's like, okay, something like David Milch is a different kind of talent. That it's not just that he is kind of on the high end of these writers. You know, maybe he is kind of a singular talent like this.
Yeah.
So to really let someone like that do what they do to the peak of their potential, it has to be in this other setting where they have they only have to do 9 episodes or 8 episodes or whatever. They get better actors. They get more money. They get, you know, all the stuff. Because in order for him to sort of succeed in the way his talent warrants, it can't be that he's doing The Good Wife. And
right.
if he became a writer for The Good Wife, it would probably improve The Good Wife. But the improvement would not relate to the real difference in talent. Now, I mean, I'm not criticizing writers for The Good Wife. I'm just saying it. That's why this, I don't know how the awards thing really factors in.
Well, the other
problem, the award things is just basically TV people giving awards to the TV people or the Grammys, the music industry rewarding itself.
That's just one of my weird things. I just wish we had a better system for that. But when we talk about TV, though, I think one of the mistakes that, especially HBO, like they try to get in business with these big, big names for a lot of money. But they're mostly people that have already peaked as artists. And you look at, some of the, especially with TV shows, the shows that really take off are created by one person. And it's usually a person that hasn't really broken through yet. Like it's this show, whatever they're working on, becomes like the best thing they ever did. And you look at like The Wire, David Simon. Sopranos, David Chase. Breaking Bad, Vince Gilligan. Like, these are all people that it seems like what confuses me about them is you would think they would constantly be looking for the next Vince Gilligan and somebody like that and not being like, let's do a show with Martin Scorsese. Like, what are the odds that Martin Scorsese is going to have, this is going to be the best thing he's ever done? Like, you know, pretty low.
Well, true, but I mean, from their perspective, it's pretty obvious why they would do that. It would be the same reason why at Grantland, it was more likely that we would have an established writer, right, than search for some unknown person who might be good and might be awful. I mean, if the expectation is that it has to be good, maybe it'll be great, but it has to be good. I mean, it's going to force people to sort of look for properties and commodities that have a track record.
But we went, I mean, at Grantland, the people that we tried to, you know, have full time were mostly people that were up and coming young people. For the most part, except for you and me. We were the two old farts.
Yeah, there was something else I wanted to ask you about regarding your some recent podcasts you did. Yeah, so this is kind of odd to do a podcast about a podcast, but I'm curious about something.
Well, can we finish this TV thing first?
Oh, it's still going on. Are we still talking about this?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I just – the one thing – you know, what is your stance on Walking Dead?
I watched the premiere, I watched the second episode, and then I'm just not a big zombie guy. I had to write about this for the New York Times a while ago, so I had to kind of catch up at that point,
yeah.
But it was purely from a perspective of doing this for work. It had nothing to do with my own interest.
Because our friend Greenwald hates Walking Dead, and Jacoby and I love it, and I just think it's an interesting show because it kind of captures the times. Like, it gets picked apart in the internet. But yet it gets 10.1 million people the last episode. It's a lot of people for AMC. And like, there's this feeling that Mad Men is a more important show than Walking Dead. And it, you know, it's better written. It's better acted. I think it's a more meaningful show. I think 25 years from now, it'll hold up. Maybe Walking Dead won't. But it's interesting that Mad Men, I think, gets, you know, a couple million people.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, Walking
Dead gets 10.
It is possible for someone to be in to The Walking Dead for purely escapist reasons. I mean, and every television show has some of that. Like, you know, you're obviously, even if you're watching reality television, to a degree you're doing it to escape from the actuality of your life. But what I'm saying with The Walking Dead, someone can be into that purely for that reason. Like, they just watch all shows with zombies in it. They watch any, you know, they read, you know, World War Z, they love zombies, this is a show about zombies, I'm going to watch it. They have almost no interest in the characters. It would be hard to imagine someone watching Mad Men purely for escapist reasons.
Yeah.
Like, it just, I don't even know, it would have, unless the only way it could be is if somebody had actually, you know, lived in New York and worked in advertising during that time period, and they just want to, like, imagine themselves as those people. But, you know, so that cuts off, you know, a huge chunk of the potential audience.
But this seems like they're not totally looking for the escapism shows as much as they should be. Like, you look at the Showtime lineup, and you look at the HBO lineup, and even FX and AMC, there are all these, like, niche shows with kind of follow the same recipe to some degree. We used to talk about Entourage, though, before that show went away. And you were saying, like, you loved Entourage because you thought it was the greatest travel. Would you say the greatest travel show ever?
It seemed like a show. Like, it was interesting to imagine the show if it was actually being produced by, like, the Los Angeles Chamber of Commerce. And they were like, we're going to show this show for people to interest them in moving to L.A., but you know what? We also need to have characters, so let's just have, you know, let's have an actor and, like, his sycophantic friend and, like, his manager and his dumb brother and an agent, and let's show what the city looks like and what kind of cars they drive and what kind of music we're playing. Like, I kind of watched it in reverse.
Yeah. Huh. I wish there were more shows like that, though. Like, I was never following the second season. I was probably disappointed in every single Entourage I watched. But at the same time, like, I knew it was a half hour where I could just turn my brain off. I could make jokes during it. It kept my attention for whatever reason. I don't know why. I kind of enjoyed it as a half hour. I guess that's the same reason I watch some of these crappy reality shows. The Challenge, for instance.
Do you feel as though, in general, let me pose it as a question like this.
Okay.
Would you prefer that your life involved more escapism or less? Would you like to escape from your real life more than you do, or would you rather be more engaged with your real life than you presently are?
That question is too. So that was like the first episode of Luck of questions. You're making my brain work too hard.
Well, I think you would know the answer.
Well, I know that why I gravitate toward most of the TV I watch is just because. Well, I watch mostly sports, but when I watch TV, it seems like I do gravitate toward these shows where I could just kind of turn my brain off and make jokes and not.
Well, do you classify sports as escapist?
I would say no, because...
I mean, Noam Chomsky would say yes. He would say that's the only reason sports exist, basically, in our culture, to remove people from thinking about the reality of the world.
When I watch sports, though, my brain is always moving, and I'm always thinking of, big picture stuff and column angles and all kinds of stuff.
So for you, it's not escapism.
You know what's escapism for me? Is hockey. Because hockey is the one sport that, and I've been watching a lot of hockey this year for whatever reason, and hockey is just simple to me. I'm not pretending to understand hockey. I don't write about hockey because I'm not sophisticated enough about it. I don't totally understand what goes on in hockey, and I don't understand why the guys need a rest after 2 minutes. And it seems like they're running plays, but I could never diagram those plays for you. But they just skate around, and it's exciting, and they hit each other, and there's an intensity to it that is missing in other sports. And I like that they settle feuds on the ice. I went to a Kings game last night. There were 4 fights in the first period. You know, and it all started because somebody hit somebody, and it was a borderline cheap hit, and the guy got hurt. Next face-off, another guy on the other team fought that guy, and it was like, you realize we have to fight now because you just did that hit. And then the rest of the period, they fought the whole period, and I don't know. Is escapism.
Let's say I could inject you with a drug that would make you an expert in hockey immediately. Do you think you would enjoy it less? Or would you enjoy it more?
I would probably pass up the drug. I don't think I want to. I don't think I want to understand hockey more than I understand it. I really like watching the Bruins, and I wouldn't go on. I wouldn't when I do a hockey podcast. I'm very careful of leaning on the experts. I don't really write about hockey ever because people could write about it in a much more sophisticated way than me. But that doesn't mean that I can't enjoy the hell out of it. I really enjoyed this season.
Well, because this leads exactly into what I want to bring up before.
Okay.
Podcast. Okay. Listen to your podcast with Bob Ryan.
Yep.
Your podcast with Larry Bird.
Okay.
Okay. So we kind of have 3 levels of people here. We have you, we have Bob Ryan, we have Bird. You love the Celtics. Grew up watching them, followed them very closely. Probably watch how many games the Celtics played this year? They played
Like 30.
30. And how many have you watched?
I mean, I've at least watched the fourth quarters and all of them.
Okay, so you've watched some of every game, but you're at a distance. You're across the country, but you're from Boston. You probably know some people kind of on the periphery of the organization, but you're kind of watching it from your perspective, where your insight and your understanding of it is almost just sort of from what you see. Then we have Bob Ryan, okay? He is closer. He's talking to the players. He's talking to the coaches. He has sources for the Celtics going back a long way. He's watched basketball for longer, okay? But at the same time, he's also being affected by what those people tell him.
Yep.
His beliefs are really built around what his sources say, and for the most part, he probably accepts some of their takes as gospel just because he trusts them, even though that person might
feasibly. Let me interrupt you for 1 second, though, because I think this was the case for Bob in the 70s and 80s, but I think the last 10, 15 years, I think he's been following, I think he's been writing about all the sports. I don't think he's as immersed in the NBA scene as he was.
Okay, so who's the beat writer for the Globe?
Well, why don't we use, let's use Mark Stein as an example, because that's somebody who goes to every Mavericks game, who has a million sources, who's talking to people constantly, who's completely immersed in everything NBA.
Okay, and then you have Bird.
Yep.
played for the Celtics, played in the league, is still involved in the business of basketball, has an intimate knowledge of the actual experience of playing because he has done so, knows Danny Ainge in a way that is different than any media person ever could. You know?
Right.
So we have these three levels. We have the person who's just sort of watching it, the person who is watching it and talking to people, and a person who actually had the experience but has these biases because he's viewing it through his own personal prism.
Yep.
If we were to talk about what is wrong with the Celtics right now, of those three people, whose take would be most accurate?
Interesting. So we're saying like the Celtics
like
version
the more,
of Mark Stein.
The more you know something, the more informed you are to comment on it. And yet at the same time, the more likely you are to be biased in a way that could be detrimental, that your beliefs could galvanize or calcify. You could have a personal opinion. You know, Bird could look at the players, and in his mind, maybe he's putting himself in their perspective because that's just the natural inclination when you see someone doing what you did. And because of that, that could give him an incorrect reading on things. I thought, like, when he talked about Kobe and LeBron.
Yep.
Do you think his take on Kobe and LeBron is more accurate than yours?
Well, let's go backwards, though. I would say I would have the worst take on the Celtics only because I've only seen them once in person. And I think, for instance, like when I was living in Boston in the late 90s and the early 2000s, and I was going to pretty much every Celtic game, or at least like 75% of them, I felt like I knew that team inside and out. And I also wasn't biased with the opinions of the coach or people in the front office or stuff like that. Like, I would have put my opinions on that 5 or 6 year stretch of teams against anybody. And the fact
because
that
you would say the most important quality in understanding a basketball team, for example, is live observation.
Yeah, I would say live, and then also like mixing it in with watching stuff on, you know, watching the replay on tape, stuff like that. But I think basketball out of all the sports, you pick up the most stuff live. And even like hockey, I'm sure there are people out there who could sit in the right seat for a hockey game and pick out different things. But basketball is the only sport that, you know, if you see enough games and you know what to look for, you can really get a feel for a team. Like even, I think I've been to like 11 or 12 Clipper games now, and I have a feel for that team. I have a better feel for the Clippers than I do for the Celtics. It's not like I like them more. It's just that I've been going to the games, and now I know, like, I can tell by the body language, by the way the guys interact, by the plays they run. I can tell who messed up a play. I can tell who's dogging it. I can tell who's mad because X happened. Like, you're going to pick it up better. I think when it gets dangerous, and this is something that happened in the mid-2000s with Doc Rivers, and, you know, I still stand by a lot of the stuff I wrote. I think Doc has now become one of the best coaches in the league. But watching those games in 05, 06, 07, what I was reading with the coverage of Doc and what people were saying was colored by the fact that people liked him and that he was a great interviewer.
When you talk about Doc Rivers, are you basically saying you were just wrong? Or you were right at the time with the information you had?
I stand by everything I wrote. I think he did a lousy job coaching those teams. I think he got better. I think it's like anything else. You do something for long enough. You learn from your mistakes. I think you get better at it.
Has he been coach of the year prior to that, though, with another team?
He was coach of the year in Orlando. And
so
then,
you're saying he was coach of the year, and then he was bad, and then he got better.
I think he struggled with the roster that he had, and I think he succeeds with a certain type of roster. He seems to succeed with veterans, with, you know, teams that can handle their own business a little bit on the court. I think he has some real strengths. He has some weaknesses, but he's addressed a lot of them. You know, he was in a great situation in 07, 08.
I've talked about this before. I feel like you are very tough on coaches in a way that I often disagree with.
I know, I probably am.
Because
I
think that you overemphasize in-game coaching decisions, which is really only 10 or 20% of the job.
Well, here, the big thing with Doc and the reason why I was so down on him was he was doing things that NBA coaches, from a success standpoint, don't normally do. Like, he would play 11 players constantly. And you just look at any successful team. They never play 11 players. They play 9 or maybe 10.
Well, they never do until – they never succeed until they do, though. I mean, that's
– but
if you're trying something different, it can't be that you're going to penalize a guy for trying something different if you're going to penalize a different guy for being uncreative. You know what
but
I'm
that,
saying?
But that's basketball, though. That you can't play 11 guys. It's never worked. Just the way the sport works and the amount of minutes people need and the kind of rotation you need to succeed and how many minutes each person should play.
So that rule, you'd say that rule is hard.
There's I would no, say that's a hard inflexion. Rule, yeah. I
think nine guys are the number of guys.
Eight or nine. You could win with eight. I think it's eight or nine, and that's it. And it's just the way the league works. And you need guys coming off the bench who are comfortable with coming off the bench. Like, I really feel like, James Harden emerged last year with Oklahoma City. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason he emerged was because they traded Jeff Green. And I haven't seen the minutes. I know he's playing. I know it's not significant.
Although, when Jeff Green was there, Harden seemed better.
I just think it opened the door for him to get more meaningful minutes and to play a little bit more and in his head to know he was playing more. You're seeing it now at the Clippers with Mo Williams. He's a guy that needs to play a certain amount of minutes or he just is not effective.
But with Doc Rivers, couldn't the argument be made that he just needed good players?
You could.
And as soon as he had good players, they were extremely successful.
But I think the 05 Celtics team was pretty good, and that team lost to a Pacers team in round one that it was coming off the Artest melee, and I forget the exact number, but I think out of the 11 best players in that series, the Celtics probably had nine of them. So, you know, Doc did not have a great run there in Boston, and he turned it around with the 08 team. I think he's one of the best coaches now. I don't know, I think you look at if you ask Browns coaches Browns fans what they feel about Bill Belichick, they would say he's terrible as a coach because he didn't succeed when he was there. And the fact remains, Doc came very close to getting fired that year of the Odin Durant thing. And I think they would have fired him except for the part that they didn't want to pay him and they were going to tank the season anyway. But, he was going to get fired there.
Would that have been a mistake?
It probably would have. They just gave him a $30 million contract.
It would have been a mistake.
The whole coaching thing is really interesting to me. And I didn't even really talk about it that much in my book because there's so few coaches that you could point to that had, an undeniable impact. And you look at the league now and, I don't even know if we could come up with five coaches that everybody, if you ask 50 people in the NBA who are the five best coaches, I think the list would be different for a lot of people now because we've lost some guys.
Also, this truncated season is so strange. It's very clear these teams aren't practicing at all.
No, you're like
that that Knicks Lakers game when I was watching it, I did find myself wondering, I wonder if this is what it was like to have watched the ABA.
Right.
Because you have Lin, who's this weird, odd player who's playing in this odd style, seems to be dominating. Kobe, on a couple occasions, would get rebounds. Just dribble down and shoot, which you just do not see happen. He did that many times.
Right.
He threw an incredible pass. He threw a pass to himself off the backboard and threw it to a guy in the wing. Did you watch this game?
I did. I mean,
yeah. That was the best play I've seen this year, I think. And as I was watching it happen, I was like, that was a strange choice he made, though. That couldn't have been the most reasonable choice on that possession. It does seem like the games, while entertaining, the level of play has been pretty awful.
I think Mike
he scores. Yeah.
Mike D'Antoni is an awesome. I think he's a much better topic for the conversation than Doc because Mike D'Antoni comes to the Suns. He gets Nash. They do this 7 seconds or less offense. They really had bad breaks there. You could argue that if they had caught a couple breaks or an injury that didn't happen here or whatever, that they may have either played in the finals or won the title.
Well, I feel like one year they got beat by San Antonio.
And that was the Nash
3 by Duncan. I was in Germany at the time.
Yep.
And I really think that if Duncan misses that shot, the Suns probably win the title.
Or they make the finals at least. Or so it was that was when they had Shaq that year. That was a good Suns team. All those Suns teams were good. So he goes to the Knicks and he's terrible the entire time and he doesn't have the right roster. And it's a classic case of a coach who can only coach one type of style, can't adapt at all. And if he doesn't have the right people, he's just useless, which is what we saw the last couple of years. And he's about to get fired this year. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, this guy on the bench who he hadn't even talked to for a couple of weeks, who didn't even bother to learn his name until the third week, this guy comes in and does a really good Nash impersonation. And now they're winning. They've won 7 straight. And everybody's like, hey, Mike D'Antoni, he knows what he's doing. he's been the same guy this whole time. All that changed was the fact that he finally, you know, he had a point guard in Phoenix and now he has one. But if he doesn't have that player, he's useless.
But that's a weird way of looking at it, though. To me, it's more reasonable. I mean, how can I say this? Okay. D'Antoni's a good coach, except during that one period when he's a terrible coach. And you're saying it's because he can only play that one style. But, I mean, a coach is built around his philosophy. I mean, if you take, you know, if you give Woody Hayes, you know, a team, if you would have given him, like, a team from BYU or whatever, and then be like, well, Woody Hayes is the bad coach. He can only win when he, you know, runs the ball up the gut and plays this guy. Well, I mean, that's what his coaching is. That's what it seems to me like. D'Antoni was in a situation where he could not get his team to agree with what he wanted to do. When he finally got a guy who was like, I play this style, he's a good coach again.
Well, there's three types of coaches. The first type is the coach that is just a caretaker, basically. You know, is somebody that he's competent enough to make sure everybody gets there on time. He's competent enough to know, all right, guys, run this offense, but he's nothing special, and there's a dime a dozen. Then there's the coach that has his system, you know, and it's like, if we run this system and you give me the right players, we're going to make some magic happen here.
Well,
and
I think there's coaches like Pat Riley who can basically decide from what talent he has to create a system around.
Those are the coaches that matter, in my opinion. And I think even, like, underrated John Fox in Denver. I don't think John Fox wanted to play T-ball ball, but he looked at his roster, he looked at what he had, and he said, you know what, let's try this. If it doesn't work, we'll tank the season, and if it does work, maybe we'll have something. And he rebuilt his entire offense during that season around what Tebow could do. I thought that was pretty great.
It was, and it was also a strange situation where, I don't know, community pressure played a bigger role than you normally see.
True.
Where that Fox was in a position where he was like, I got to play this guy. If for no other reason to have him fail, so that they will end this idea that somehow he's going to save us, and then if he fails, then they'll turn on him the way sports fans always do, and we can just give up and move on. And now he's, I mean, I'm happy about this, but he's kind of stuck with him now.
Well, this is why I love Belichick, just as a Patriot fan, because I always feel like that this guy's going to try anything, and if you say, like, what is...
Okay, but that's the same premise of playing 11 guys, Bill.
No, but I'm
like,
saying...
Like, Belichick, there's a lot... If Belichick failed, it would be very easy for someone to say, what do you expect from a guy who plays as wide receivers at defensive back?
No, we're talking about different try anything. What I'm saying is, Belichick looks at his roster and goes, all right, this is what I have. I have to figure out how to make this work. Whereas a lot of, like Steve Spurrier... If he had a roster and it didn't fit exactly what he could do, he wouldn't know what to do. Belichick just looks at it and goes, I guess I got to do this. I guess I got to scrap the 4-3 and play this way instead. Or I guess I got to play six defensive backs because...
Yeah, and his success with Castle that year kind of validated.
Yeah, Belichick always rolls with the punches.
Anybody in Cleveland who was like, Belichick can only succeed if his team is awesome. I really think that the fact that they were a very competitive team... having lost their best player. I mean, that's, you know.
Well, here's a good example of a really bad coaching job. So Terry Porter takes over from Mike D'Antoni and decides that Phoenix is going to be this power low post offense and that they're not going to run and he's not really going to use Nash, and Nash is just basically going to be a guy who dumps it into Shaq. Mm-hmm. He gets fired in like 45 games. Like, that's a really, that to me, that's just somebody being a dope. You know,
but,
just
okay,
somebody who's looking at their personnel
know,
and going, this
is stupid.
You
know more about the inside of this stuff than I do. But to me, though, I thought that was an extension of sort of Phoenix organization collectively deciding, do we want to be a team that is exciting and wins a bunch of games and cannot win a title? Or do we want to somehow, you know, make the – it was like, you know, when I did that story on the Triangle and I was talking to Jackson, Phil Jackson's thing is still like, you've got to have someone who scores in the post. The direction that most basketball teams are going is wrong, and that's, you know, the reason Dallas won last year is because they have a guy they can throw to who can, with his back to the basket, make a 9-foot shot every time. You know, and I wonder if in Phoenix it was just sort of like, we can keep doing this, and we'll always be good, but we'll never win a title. We had our shot that one year we talked about, and it's not going to work.
But you could have had it both ways. I mean, you could have still you could have kept the ball in Nash's hands, dumped it into Shaq. Like the year before, their offense was really good. And as you said, like Duncan made that crazy three, but I thought that was a really good Suns team. They just kind of lost a sense of what their identity was. And, you know, if you're a coach, you got to look at your roster and say, what do I have and how do I make this work? When you talk about trying stuff, like there's degrees of trying stuff. Like there was a Clipper game recently where Vinny Del Negro was just missing very basic things in the last 2 minutes. Like for instance, if you have, I think it was like 30 seconds left, Blake's at the line and shooting two free throws, and the other team is going to call timeout after the second free throw because it's clear that that's what always happens in the NBA. And Blake's not a great free throw shooter, and he's got Mo Williams as one of the two rebounders. And like any smart coach would just go offense, defense, put Reggie Evans in case Blake misses it, you get a better chance. If they get the rebound, they're going to call timeout anyway. And he left Mo Williams in there, and they did miss the free throw. But that's like, that's what I mean. Like, if you're missing basic stuff like that, that makes me not trust you.
Well, I know, but I guess to me, that's an example of what I say is that you're overemphasizing these specific game decisions when a coach's most important work is at practice. And in the analysis,
I would agree with that.
And I think that it's always,
You can miss basic stuff, though. I mean, if you're missing basic stuff, that makes me not trust you. Or if, like, for instance, another thing Vinny does, which is really weird, he'll play Blake for the entire third quarter, and then the first 2 minutes of the fourth quarter, like the first minute, and then he'll take him out, and then he'll bring Blake in like 2 minutes later. But like, no other coach in the league uses that substitution pattern. Usually, they take them out because there's a timeout at the 3 minute mark, the end of the quarter, and then at the 10 minute mark of the fourth quarter, and people usually try to get rest for their players in that little window where there are the three timeouts. And Vinny ignores that and uses a whole different substitution pattern. And Blake is like routinely wiped out in the fourth quarter. Like he's out of energy because he's played too many minutes in a row. But I mean, it's just stuff that if you're going to think outside the box, like don't like take the box and actually break it and then think outside the box, I guess would be my point. You don't agree?
Well, I mean, I don't know. My natural reaction now when I see stuff like that is to conclude that there might be something that I don't know that's going on here.
See, Vinny's an innovator with minutes.
What?
You think he's an innovator with...
Well, no, it's just sort of like, I don't... Maybe he had to come out for some reason unrelated to the rotation.
Oh.
Or maybe, you know, or maybe there was some, you know, it's too easy, I think, now to feel like an expert because we can get so much information and see so many games, and yet there's still a distance between us and what's actually happening. And I'm always very reticent to criticize coaches because I don't feel like I am in a position to really understand the interpersonal relationships they're dealing with. And what these guys are really like. Now, I know you know Blake some. Like, you're friends.
I barely know him, yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, not to take a shot at him, but does he have a surprisingly slow release on his jumper?
Yeah, he's got some flaws.
I feel like that's got, you know, because right now it's okay because people are still afraid he's going to blow by and dunk on him. But it seems like his jumper is slow in release.
He's got things he needs to work on.
He talks to the ref too much, too.
This goes back to the coaching thing because I think Vinny's one of those let the inmates run the asylum type guys, and he trusts the veterans a lot. Blake stink eyes every official in the league, which is a huge mistake. And I watched Antoine Walker do this in the late 90s, and it got to the point where Antoine just wouldn't get a call because the refs were like, screw you. You know, you show me up every time I don't call a foul for you. Blake has turned into one of these guys that if he misses a shot, he glares at the ref after, which is the dumbest thing you could do. That's one issue. The release on the jump shot, it just shouldn't take 2 seconds to release a jump shot.
Yeah,
you know?
I don't get it.
It really hurts his game. And then the foul shooting to me is the one that scares me because his foul shooting has been so bad this year. And it can really pass the point of no return. Like there are guys who Bob Ryan in our podcast mentioned George Begetis. Like, it ruined George Begetis' career. The guy was one of the best 10 players in the league. He was out of the league at age 31, and partially because of free throw shooting. I think it ruined Antoine Walker's career. It's ruined Andres Biedron's career too. You know, not that that career mattered that much, but, if you get in your head, like, you don't want to get fouled because you're going to miss the free throws, it changes the way you play. But on the other hand, I think because Blake's on such a good team and, you know, he's been so much fun to watch and the YouTube clips, all this stuff. I think people do nitpick with him. Even on Wednesday night, we were watching, we're saying, like, Blake, I was with Mays. We're saying, yeah, Blake's having a crappy game. We look up, he's got 19 points and 13 rebounds in the third quarter or something. Like, he works so hard that he's always going to get his numbers, and he really does give a crap.
You can't really criticize him simply because of the rebounding.
He really tries, and he cares, you know, and he's reckless with how he throws his body around. Like, mm-hmm. I don't think there are five or six players who play harder than him from beginning to end. I do think, though, that, you know, just looking at their big picture, like, the free throw shooting is a real issue. Because if you can't go to him at the end of the games because he's going to get fouled, then that puts everything on Chris Paul. Who can do it from, you know, he did it last night in Portland.
Yeah, I saw that game.
But, you know, you mentioned how Jackson said that you can't win unless you have somebody who can score from 9 feet with his back to the basket. I actually agree with that, which is why I don't know who's going to come out of the West, because Oklahoma City in the last 4 minutes of a game has nobody who can reliably get within 15 feet of the basket and make a shot. It's all jump shots. And they have one of the best scorers, you know, of the last 25 years in their team. But still, it's all jump shots. And Miami is like this too, to some degree. They're a jump shooting team. And when the jump shots go away, you're kind of screwed. And that's one of the reasons why I have no idea who's going to win this year. I have no feel at all for it. I've never had a season like this.
Well, the lockout is part of it, because the games don't seem like I do wonder, you know, okay, using the Jackson philosophy, well, are we underrating the potential of the Lakers in the playoffs?
No, I'm not.
I mean, because they have two guys who can do that, and this is, I sense this. I mean, Kobe's an interesting situation always, but this year especially so. Like, he seems to be realizing certain things about his life and his position in the basketball culture, and also ignoring certain things that in the past he always knew. But I'm wondering how this is going to play out down the stretch. Like, I wonder if he is almost viewing this regular season as essentially meaningless, because it certainly seems to be the way he's playing at times.
Yeah, I agree with that. And he's thinking about that record, and he's playing that way. But, you know,
and seeding won't matter in the way.
No, seeding won't matter
at all.
The other thing is, in the playoffs, everything slows down. You know, everybody plays defense. The games are in the 90s and the high 80s instead of the 100s. And those are the games that the Lakers play. Like, they don't get fast break points. Everything's half court. And
okay, but you know what's going to be very interesting about this year's playoffs, though?
What?
Players are going to be more rested than they are now. They're going to have more days where they don't play. So I'm wondering if the scoring will go down or if it will actually go up this year.
It's possible.
You know, I mean, because, you know, I think that I saw somewhere that the Heat won four road games in a row or something, and this has never happened somehow. They've won, like, they played four games on four consecutive days and won all of them or whatever.
Right.
But it's not really a reflection of the team. I mean, they're very good, but it's more reflection against they're playing against teams who are as tired at home as they are on the road.
The problem, though, is that because this season is so brutal, I think there's going to be so many nagging injuries. You know, it's going to be like, yeah, on paper, they're going to have more rest in the playoffs, but their bodies are going to be so banged up at that point that I don't know if it's going to matter. And that's the thing, like, we talk about the Lakers. Like, yeah, if I know for a fact that those three guys are going to be healthy for that 8-week stretch, I would be very afraid of them. But it's really hard for me to believe that they're going to keep those three guys healthy with the burden that they have.
But if everybody's beat up and everybody's tired, then the advantage goes back to Kobe. He's the most talented guy in a situation where everyone is dying.
Well, but he's not, though, because I would argue the advantage would go to Dallas then, who's quietly 19-11 right now, but Dirk proved yeah, last year that he's better than
true.
Kobe in
that's
a big
true.
Spot.
Yep, that and ultimately that might be the team who ends up coming out again somehow.
Wouldn't that be crazy? They're dumping salary this year. And Dallas is funny because they really think they have a chance at Darren Williams and Dwight Howard together, but to make that happen, they need to trade Sean Marion. And Sean Marion's playing great. And Cuban is now tweeting like Sean Marion things at his Twitter account, like another great night of defense by Sean Marion, all D 2012, like stuff like that. And he's clearly doing it because they would love nothing more than to trade Sean Marion. They would trade him right now if you made him an offer, as long as they got an expired contract back. So Dallas is doing this simultaneous carve out cap for 2012, but also competing for the title thing, which is, if they pull it off, I think it'll be legendary. Okay. If they trade Sean Marion, they could get Dirk Nowitzki, Darren Williams, and Dwight Howard on the same team next year pretty easily, which is nuts.
That would be crazy.
And if I had to bet my life on a West team, I think I would pick them right now, just with the roster they have. So I don't know. So they're trying to pull off a whole bunch of stuff. I think the Clips, I just feel like there's too many guys who haven't been in that spot before for them to imagine them winning four straight rounds. And Oklahoma City seems to me one guy short.
Well, that was like in the Ryan podcast. He pretty much said, like, no shot for them. I thought he went a little far with that.
Yeah, he probably did. He values, like, having the old guys around. And we saw that last year in the finals, you know. Kidd made big plays. Terry made big plays. Sean Marion made big plays. Like, there's something to be said. You know, the other thing, we got to wrap this up, but the other thing we didn't talk about was how great of a season LeBron James is having. And everybody's just kind of doesn't, I guess he's just never going to get credit anymore.
Well, I mean, it is interesting. I mean, let's say Lynn keeps playing great. He consistently has 20 and 12 games for much of this season, and the Knicks end up being the 3 seed in the East. How much emphasis is there going to be on Lynn for MVP?
He won't get emphasis. I don't see that.
In New York,
nah.
He would clearly be the most valuable player in terms of how valuable he is. I'm not saying I would vote for this guy. I'm saying, though, that the Knicks were going no place. He starts playing. They keep winning. He's playing very well. He's the vortex of that team. There's not a lot of people who are like, well, you know, we got to reward LeBron. I mean, I feel like this could be a real interesting MVP race if Lynn plays great the whole rest of the year. I mean, now, that's speculating on a lot of stuff, but, you know, that year that Chamberlain averaged 50 points a game, he didn't win the MVP.
True.
Not impossible that a guy having an insane statistical year.
It wouldn't be Lynn that won it, though. Well, you're forgetting the part that after the All-Star break, the Knicks' schedule becomes... The Knicks have the hardest schedule in the league after the All-Star break.
Well, absolutely. We're talking about a hypothetical.
But, I mean, they'd have to go like...
What if they succeed with this schedule, Bill? I'm saying, like, what if this happens?
Okay, so they were 8-15. I would say for him to have an MVP chance, if he continued to play as well as he's been playing, they would have to go, like, 47-6. Like, some crazy record with him for that to be a discussion. 45-8.
I don't know. Considering the location of that franchise, if they're the third, seed in the East, I guarantee you this is going to be the thing everyone is talking about down the stretch.
The guy that, in my opinion, the guy who's going to become the sentimental media favorite will be Chris Paul.
Oh, no way. No way, Bill. There's no way. You can't make an argument that Paul... warrants it over LeBron. You can make a weird, flawed argument that Lynn would in this situation.
No, but what if the Clips end up being the one seed in the West and they win, they go 49-17, something like that.
Well,
and
I mean,
people are like, oh, look, Chris Paul, he's single-handedly saved the Clippers, and because of him, Kenyon Martin signed there.
Then he's an all-star in the eyes of most people. In reality, he's the best player on that team. I think the perception is that he's the second guy on the team. Certainly the second.
As a season ticket owner, I can vouch he's the best guy on the team. And it's actually kind of – I don't like that Blake Griffin is introduced last because it's Chris Paul's team. Blake Griffin's on it.
Well, I mean, sure, sure. But what I'm not saying whether or not this is warranted. I'm just saying that's the way it's perceived, you know. And I don't think that I see him as an all-star, but I don't I'd be really shocked. Because
MVP, do you want to know the MVP odds right now? I could tell you off the top of my head because I looked yesterday.
So, I have no idea what they are.
LeBron is -150, so you'd have to bet $150 on him to win a 100. And that's moved. He was +250 like 3 weeks ago, and that's moved down to -150. Kobe is plus, I think, 250. I think Durant is +250, and then Chris Paul is +450. Those are the top four MVP odds. And Durant, you know, if Oklahoma City ends up going, you know, being a one seed and going 54-12 or some record like that, I think Durant would be pretty heavily in the mix.
Well, I mean, because it's called MVP, it adds this weird element of you can make an argument that supports somebody who's not the best player. Because if it was the most outstanding player, there is no question.
For me, it's like, and I think LeBron's the most valuable, too. Like, I just think this has been his most amazing year because he's actually having his best year with this insane schedule and with the way he plays and stuff. Like, I just can't believe that he can just churn this out every night.
Well, but there again, I don't know if – I mean, I know what you're saying. That definitely, like, makes sense superficially. But I wonder if you have such a physical advantage and everyone is feeling sort of aware of this, then that – that actually moves a guy like him in the opposite direction.
So you think his physical advantage becomes bigger?
There are some situations where guys just do not have that. You know, they're tired, and if they're just a fraction slow, they can't get in front of him, and he can just go to the basket. Especially late in games, it seems like he can just go to the rim.
Yeah, I guess there's two ways to look at it. Because I'm looking at it from the sense of this guy is such a freak, like even the schedule can't stop him. He's as unstoppable and playing better than he's ever played during this insane schedule where he doesn't get to practice. He's got at least three new guys in the rotation. Dwayne Wade was hurt. They have a bullseye every night. Every time they play anybody, it's the biggest game of the year for the other team. And nothing phases him. I've been pretty impressed, but at the same time, I wouldn't trust him in the last 2 minutes of a playoff game. So that hasn't changed either.
That is not.
Chuck Klosterman, we will continue this at another time on the BS Report. We will read you on Greatland.com.
Anytime.
We will watch you drive the Jeremy Lin MVP bandwagon, which I can't believe you just tried to build.
I'm just telling you, people are going to say it if it keeps happening.
All right. Well, you heard it here. We'll talk to you soon.
Target the channel. Whoa.
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.